That was beautiful. And I think so true of what we always need to hear, that no matter how big the waves may seem, our God is bigger than the waves. Where's Lamar when I need him? That was like an amen moment. So if somebody would just do like a deep Barry White-esque amen. Doug? Thank you, buddy. Thank you, Pitts. That was beautiful. And I did not detune your guitar. But I would have totally owned it if I had. Because I would have warned you that I was going to. I said if I was at a church where we had a band every week, I would basically want to just go and detune all the instruments to teach the band about patience, you know? That's pastoral care. It's good to be with you today. We're going to begin, again, setting our second week of talking about getting Jesus. The dual ideas of both having Jesus, as in, yes, I've got me some Jesus, as we might say in the South, and also getting, as in knowing Jesus. And we have a couple of really profound stories today. Before we talk about the gospel narrative, we have to come back to our favorite epistle of James, where we've been for several weeks, and everybody loves James because James is always so upbeat, right? James ends today's letter basically saying, you big dummies, you got to stop with your double-mindedness. That's what everybody wants to read, right? Everybody runs to the mailbox looking for the next installment of the letter of James with the same fervor as you look for your Alagasco or Alabama power bill. James has this great concept, and I want to focus particularly, I just want to put this in our minds, this one verse in the middle. He's talking about ambition, and he's talking about warring with one another and basing ourselves on whether we're better than each other. But then right in the middle of that, right at the beginning of chapter 4, he says, these conflicts and disputes among you, where do they come from? And then this line, do they not come from your cravings that are at war within you? Now that is deep problematic truth. That most of the time, what we are at war with one another is not so much about one another, but it is about our own conflicted nature. We are at war with ourselves. Hold that tidbit and let's talk about these wonderful disciples again. Last week, as we started talking about getting Jesus, we talked about Jesus outside Caesarea Philippi asking the disciples, who do you say that I am? And they said, Elijah, John the Baptist. And then Peter, being awesome, stands up and says, you're the Messiah. And Jesus says, shh, don't tell anybody. And then Jesus says to those 12 gathered, so here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go suffer and die. And Peter says, Messiah, no, that's not right. You are wrong. I believe you're mistaken. And then Jesus says, get behind me, which is the same root word as follow me. The same word with which he calls Peter. He says, no, still, remember, I'm in charge, and you're following me in the way that I'm laying out. And then he starts spreading this message about how he must be the one who suffers and dies at the hands of the authorities. In between that story and today's story, the transfiguration happens. So Jesus takes three of the disciples, Peter among them, goes up to the top of the mountain and gets all glorified. It's kind of like our back row of the sanctuary a little bit earlier. The sun at about 10 o'clock shines right on Georgianne, and I don't want to embarrass Georgianne more than I already have by saying her name like three times, but I was sitting there during worship this morning thinking, yeah, like that, like it's a little blinding, you know? I mean, you got to shield yourself from whatever's happening. Well, that's what the transfiguration is. It's this powerful moment of the display of the power of God in the person of Jesus. And that's important in terms of the story because Jesus is talking about being powerless. He's talking about getting rid of the power. He's talking about suffering. He's talking about things not commonly associated with the power of God. In the midst of his talk about suffering and death, there's a moment where he takes his core leadership up on top of the mountain, and they get a glimpse that even though he's talking about suffering, that really he is the embodied power of the Creator. And he is transfigured. And they get this one brief glimpse of hope in the midst of this story about suffering. Eventually, they'll get that, by the way. That's the end of the story. Eventually, all of the disciples will get that that's what they need. That this hope in the midst of suffering is what keeps us through the cross to the empty tomb. But before we get there, they keep walking. And as they're walking, the disciples are arguing amongst themselves. And Jesus asks them what they're arguing about. And if there's one verse I want you to really pick out in this from the Gospel of Mark, it's this one. He says, "What are you guys arguing about?" But they were silent. I thought about doing a little social experiment today and making our discipline of silence about 15 minutes long. You'd just be like, did he forget? Like, are we done? Because it's an awkward thing. The first time you come into a church, if you're not familiar with practicing silence, public, corporate silence is weird. That's a reason so many of us talk so much. Because when we're hanging out with people and they don't talk back, we just keep on talking. Because somebody has got to fill up that space. The disciples grow a little bit here. This is a great example of how they're getting Jesus a bit more than before. They're not right. They've been fussing about who's going to be the best. And in the midst of that fussing, Jesus says, "Hey, what are you talking about?" And you all know that moment, right? When you're talking about someone you shouldn't be, and they're just out of earshot, and they come around the corner and say, "What are you talking about?" And you don't know what to say because you weren't talking about something you should have been to begin with. Well, remember, Peter last week, even in the midst of being wrong, doesn't hesitate to speak up. So I want to say that the disciples here exhibit a little growth. When confronted by the reality of their own wrongness, they just stay silent. And I would make this point, if you get nothing else. When you are not certain that what you are doing is from God, silence is a pretty good place to start. We are culturally not good at silence. We're much better at putting a bunch of people in front of microphones and letting them yell at each other. Silence is tough because listening is hard. True, deep listening means getting outside of yourself, getting outside of whatever you're planning to say next, and actually being present. I think Jesus makes this point a little stronger because in the midst of this, while he is talking with them and while they remain silent after they've been caught arguing about something really ridiculous, he starts saying these very Jesus-type things, right? You have to know, if we're being honest, if we were walking with Jesus, we would often be in the same shoes as the disciples. If you walked or worked or had friends who talked like Jesus did, you would either think they were constantly doing Yoda impressions or that they were just weird and you would stop hanging out with them because here they are, caught in the midst, and Jesus just, you know, says, "Hey, look, you didn't answer me. I'm not sure what you were talking about, but sit down." And he says, look, "Whoever wants to be first must be last and servant of all." Unprompted. It's weird. But he makes it go even further because then he grabs this little child and he brings this child over and says, "Whoever welcomes this one welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes God." I want you to look at the cover of your worship guide today. I love all these old classical pictures. I like that Jesus looks a little scared in this one. So you've got this guy, you got Jesus, one child, holding the hand of another, And then you've got these people around the corner. We could talk about some art history and some chiaroscuro and the use of shadow, but you've got everybody in shadow on this side, right? And you've got Jesus in the light, looking a little bit worried. What are they doing? Maybe you don't read it that way. We could also talk about the psychology of how we read art. And the fact that since I'm reading Jesus is worried, what's going on with me? Ask me later, I probably won't tell you. Jesus in this picture I think is great because he's kind of got this defensive posture. His body is leaning away towards this child, towards this woman, towards this person wrapped away from this standing up man. Jesus does love children. And there are plenty of places where we can talk about all that means. Jesus says, unless you come like a little child, you won't get the kingdom. And we could unpack that for another hour and still not be done. But in this instance, in the middle of a conversation about who's going to be the best, Jesus takes a child for a very particular reason. Children are great. They are innocent. They do carry teddy bears around in their mouths, no matter how big those those children get. Children are great, but children in first century Israel are also without worth, without power. They have no standing in society and could be dismissed with the flap of a hand. Yes, we must become like children. But what Jesus is saying here is unless you can welcome the one who brings nothing to the table, you're not welcoming me. I don't know about you guys, but I love Michael Jackson. Yeah? I mean, come on. No, we'll have to work on that. We're going to work on Amber and the Beatles and you and Michael Jackson. It'll all be good. I grew up in the age where Michael Jackson was not only at the top of the charts, but the ethos that he perpetuated through how awesome he was a part of my childhood. He had the back-to-back pieces of Who's Bad and Beat It, right? As an adult, I realized that Michael Jackson in a knife fight is never going to win, right? But as a kid, when Slash is playing guitar, you know Who's Bad. And if you're in a car with me and you ever hear anybody peel out in their really awesome car, that is what I will say to you. Who's Bad? And I expect you to respond with something from that song as well. If you don't, you may have to walk. Just kidding, probably. Those two songs I bring up because that is such a part of the American identity. It's such a part of who we are. You know, I talk a lot about pacifism because I believe Jesus was a pacifist and I don't like to be violent. But I have to confess there was a time when I was taking some martial arts that most of the time my question was, how big a boy is he? The answer was often bigger than me, by the way. I thought I was awesome and tough and bad. I was raised in an upper middle class household. I never missed a meal. I never had to walk when I could ride. I am not bad. You get what I'm saying? But there is something in us that wants to compare ourselves to others, that wants to make sure that we are the most powerful person in the room. And we measure that power differently. When we're kids, it's about whose dad can beat up who, right? Then it's about who can beat up who. And then it's about, well, who's smarter than who? And who's doing better on the honor roll? And then it's about, well, who's driving what? And who's got more money in their bank account? And who lives where? We will never run out of ways to compare ourselves to each other. And we will never embody the message of Christ so long as we continue to do so. It comes back to this question from James. All this comparison, all this strife, all this wondering about who's bad and who needs to beat it. is it really not that you're just at war with yourself? See, Jesus understands that the child doesn't need to have any worth as long as the child can understand that the child is welcomed, even when they bring nothing. But most of us are torn up inside because we don't think we're good enough. And so we spend our energy making sure we're better than our neighbor. The scandal of the gospel, the remarkable thing about grace, is that you don't bring anything. Or in the words of an old hymn, Jesus paid it all. You didn't even pick up the tip. That's in yours, right? Do we sing that one today? No. We are a society where if you get invited to dinner, what's the first question you ask? What are we having? And a little child shall lead them. If you get invited to dinner, you say, what can I bring? I just want to make sure that I'm contributing some worth to this equation. But Jesus says, you want to welcome me? You look for those who have no worth, and you get to know them. And not only then will you be welcoming me, this strange Nazarene who's been walking around talking about suffering, but you will be welcoming Yahweh, the God who creates and sustains. There are plenty of weeks where I think that I have it enough together that I am bringing something to the equation. And there are weeks when I am reminded that I don't. And I don't like the weeks where I'm reminded that I still get things wrong. Guess what, though? If I live in this uncomfortable silence with myself for long enough to learn not to shun the fact that there is something I got wrong, but to embrace it that I am beloved anyway, it transforms my imperfection into the receptor of grace. I'm not telling you I get there all the time. But what I'm telling you is that we're not getting the gospel so long as we think it is about what we bring. And if we really want to get Jesus, then we need to start looking for the people that we keep thinking bring nothing and make sure that we're welcoming them and maybe even becoming like them so that we are open-armed, empty-handed, ready to receive grace. Amen.